Welcome to Just Talk. I'm your host, Hami. Today, we're joined by Amy Gurr, one of the lead attorneys representing Mahmoud Khalil, the Palestinian graduate student at Columbia University and permanent resident of the United States who was recently detained or kidnapped by ICE. And his case raises a series of serious questions about the state of free speech, political repression and targeting, and immigration law in the United States. Amy, thank you for joining me on Let's Just Talk.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. And I want to begin by setting the stage. Mahmoud Khalil's case has become a flashpoint in a national conversation on immigration, civil liberties, and political dissent. And he was just the first of many to come, as we'll see. Can you briefly summarize the fact of his case and Mahmoud's current legal status?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think something that Mahmoud and I actually have spoken about a great deal that I think is a really important context that can get lost because of the hugeness of where he is currently, right? Like literally right now, because I just talked to him. And that is the student movement more broadly, and particularly the actions of the student movement basically starting October 8th of 2023. But of course, the student movement regarding Palestine and many other really critical issues, intersectional issues like climate, LGBTQIA rights, Black Lives Matter and Black liberation, Indigenous rights, and so many other rights, so many other movements, who often tend to coalesce with and around Palestine as well. It's a meeting place of a lot of intersectional activism, Palestine is. And so, you know, I think that at Columbia early on, the students were organized early. And this sort of cross-sectional group of student organizers who had been working on a lot of different issues came together to protest against the genocide, to protest against the U.S. involvement in the genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid of Palestinian people, to also challenge anti-Palestinian racism and so many other levels and layers, scholasticide, ecocide, you know, all these kind of issues, anti-apartheid movements and the connection between, for example, what's happening in the Congo and some of what's been happening in Palestine and the ways in which extractive economies work on spaces. And so the students got really organized and they were doing really powerful work to also try to pressure the university to make their investments less harmful. I mean, I think that's right. The easiest summary, right, is to like the university, a lot of its endowment involves investments in weapons manufacturers and other, large corporations that are harmful to the environment and so many other things. And so the students got organized and they, as a collective of organizations, and they were effective. I think that's actually the truth of the matter is Columbia started to lead other students and other movements in the United States and across the world against the genocide in Gaza and broader interrelated issues in Palestine and Israel's role in those actions, you know, as somebody committing, as a country committing genocide, as a country effectuating ethnic cleansing and apartheid. And so the students got organized and started doing all these actions, which I think a lot of people that listen to your show are probably aware of. And the reason that context is important is because all eyes in the United States, or many eyes in the United States, turn to Columbia University. Because one of the questions that I get often is, why Mahmoud? Like, why him? Why was he the first, so to speak? And so that's why I give this Columbia background. The second layer to layer on top of that is the profound doxing and harassment that a lot of these students began experiencing from organizations like Canary Mission, Beitar USA, and some others, as well as internal actors at Columbia who were like taking photographs of student faces and posting them, posting personal information. There were trucks driving by campus with students' faces and names on them, or around campus. And part of what happened to Mahmoud is that he was a visible Columbia student, a visibly Palestinian Columbia student, who is an incredibly effective communicator and became a negotiator and a mediator for all of the student movements that were coalescing around Palestine and who were negotiating with the administration regarding these, issues that I was talking about. And so he would speak to the press, he would speak to the administration, he would speak amongst the students groups. He was an effective negotiator and mediator. He was trusted by all parties. He's a diplomat. He's a human rights defender and he's a diplomat. And so over time, as he did more press and his role became more visible, the doxing and the harassment increased. And right before March 8th, when he was taken, there the doxing and harassment increased multifold. And he was being tagged to ICE, to Marco Rubio, to the president, to the White House, all these different. He was on lists and he was, allegedly on these lists. I've never seen them, of course. And he even alerted Columbia that he was becoming afraid of being a target. And I think he became a target because Columbia was so central in all of this. He was so visible. And, he had a very prominent role as a negotiator between all the different parties. And so on the night of March 8th, after all of this building escalation, ICE agents arrived at the building. You can see it in the video. They followed him and his wife into the building and identified themselves as law enforcement, and basically said that he was going to be detained, that they were going to take him because his student visa had been revoked. And he had I don't know how he stayed calm enough for this, frankly, but he kept a cool head and called me on the phone. And one of the agents there took the phone and I spoke with him. And, he told me why. I asked, "Do you have a warrant?" "Yes, I have an administrative warrant." "Can I see it? Have you shown it to Mr. Khalil?" "No. I'll email it to you," but he never asked for my contact information. And basically the long and the short is they said that the Secretary of State had revoked his student visa. And when I informed them that Mahmoud has a green card, they said that the Secretary of State had also revoked that. And basically, the long and the short is they took him. They cuffed him and they took him. And it was really hard for his wife to even get information about where they were taking him. But we learned that he was taken to 26 Federal Plaza in Manhattan. When we hung up the phone, well, the agent hung up on me, but when his wife and I hung up the phone, I contacted an immigration attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and we got to work and we filed what's called a federal habeas claim, which we can talk about if you'd like. But we stayed up literally all night and got it filed, and that is to basically preserve the federal court's jurisdiction over the body of Mahmoud. Like habeas is of the body, but they took him to to New Jersey and then to Louisiana, and have since issued their determination, not determination, sorry. They've issued their accusations, or the reasons that they can, that they are giving to try to revoke his green card.
And what are these
So,
accusations?
yeah, so there's a couple. I'm going to turn the light on. I think it's getting darker. So there are a couple. When all of this first started, the first notice to appear that Mahmoud received included a section of the Immigration and Nationality Act, Ina is what it's called. And I should have pulled up the number. I don't have it in front of me. But basically, it's a provision in the Ina, and I think the statute is 1226, that says that the Secretary of State has made a determination that this person's presence in the United States is a threat or a danger to American foreign policy or to the nation's foreign policy, and foreign relations and things like that. That's I'm not reading the statute directly, but that's the essence of the statute. So basically, they're saying that the statute is basically alleging, or stating that somehow Mahmoud's presence in this country is a threat to its foreign policy. They then updated. Yeah, we can talk about that crazy thing, but then they updated it, and they also included that he did not include his affiliation or relationship with UNRWA and QUAD, which is the Columbia University Apartheid and Divest Anti-Apartheid and Divest QUAD, and that he should have they're alleging that he should have stated those things on his green card application. And, of course, they've gone on the bully pulpit to then say if they had known he was going to come here and protest, they never would have let him in.
We've seen the videos of Marco Rubio, and every time one of them speaks is like, who do they expect is their audience, that they're feeding this to? Like, I get it, like their base and people who support them no matter what will buy into this, or people who actually want to see this happen for their own political reasons will buy into it. But like, really, that one student is a threat to the world's biggest empire that we've ever seen in our lifetime, or our predecessor's lifetime. I mean, is he much of a threat if you could just disappear him overnight? But that's a question within itself. I want you to talk about the legality of this, whether or not there is historical precedent for what they're doing right now. And then we can dive into what this actually means for the broader population, because, you start with issues or a group of people who are most vulnerable, right? You start with issues where, like immigration, where people don't have enough compassion around it, and they're like, use it as a scapegoat. But overall, this is ultimately about political dissent and disagreeing with views that, like, and having views that deters from what the establishment is doing. And so you're a lawyer, so I don't want to get into like the politics of it all, but if they can disappear a green card holder because of their political views tomorrow, they can disappear a citizen because of his or her political views, and they can just say, oh, they had this view about this and they were a threat to national security. Then what? You've already set the precedent for it. But I'll let you talk about the historical precedent for this.
Yeah, no, and one of the things, so I'm really lucky because I went back to law school as a grown adult. Like I lived in the world and worked for a while when I went back to law school. And something I think, and this is relevant to your question overall, something I think that is lacking in many law schools, not all, is we teach the law as if it's something that is like written down somewhere at some point in time and that we all just should defend it or follow it. And law is politics and politics is law, right? So a lot of our laws were drafted as a political response to something or a form of political repression of some kind. I mean, even when I took property law, for example, and started learning about the doctrine of discovery and so many other facets of the law that are centered and based in property rights, which are the essence of building wealth, then you start to realize that like all of our criminal statutes emanate out of protecting property and wealth. And you start thinking about things a lot differently.
Or even how
And
civil rights came out of a political movement. Those
oh,
weren't things
yes,
that
no,
were
that's right.
entrenched
It can
in
swing
law.
in both ways. Exactly. Like, and this is, I think, we can definitely address that aspect of it as well. So on the one hand, you have so for example, you have the a number of really draconian laws that have been passed. For example, stacking sentencing, laws where like a person could face a significant amount of time if in order to if they shot some allegedly shot somebody and the gun was out of the window of a car. Like it's that specific that you can have like a higher sentence if that's your action. What was that in reaction to? Like who, you know what I mean? Like, so some of those laws started when the mafia had a lot of control and it was in regards to trying to cut back on mafia violence. And a lot of it was also like post Watts and post a lot of developments out of South Central LA and other spaces where it was allegedly like gang repression and things like that. So who are the bodies and who are the people? They were ethnic minorities or national, nationality minorities and black individuals in the United States who were the action was a political action. We're scared of these people, so we're going to punish them more. And that's just one example. There are obviously numerous. In the case of the INA provision under which the Secretary Rubio has invoked in the case of Mahmoud, that I actually haven't had time yet to fully dig into the history, but there's a really good article in the foreword that came out shortly after Mahmoud was taken that lays down that in around 1951, 1952, during McCarthyist era, where there was the Red Scare, the fear of communists being in the United States. And the scapegoat with communism was black people, NAACP, anyone, or any of those big Supreme Court cases where they were trying to get the member rolls because they assumed that members of the NAACP had crossover membership in communist party activities. And another group of people were Jews in the United States, particularly those who had recently emigrated in the 30s and 40s and 20s, 30s and 40s after the pogroms began in Eastern Europe and then moved westward into Germany and Nazi Germany. So a lot of people who were scapegoated for the fear of the communist takeover of the United States, Jews and Black Americans were under fire by McCarthyism. This provision of INA was to give the Secretary of State basically permission that if they found that someone was affiliated with the Communist Party, they could declare that they're a danger to the foreign policy of the United States and remove them. Now, the question I often get that I think other members of our legal team might be able to answer is how often this applied to people who are lawful permanent residents or green, otherwise known as green card holders or LPRs in the United States. And that I'm not sure of. I think it was my understanding that this provision had typically been used with people on people or to get, to remove people from the country who had more like sort of fluid statuses, like a visa that was revocable or something like that. But I do think that in the era when it originally was enacted, that the version of green card that people had, that some of them were victims of this, the enactment of this law and then, the use of it to remove people. But that's the provision. It came out of McCarthyist, the Red Scare in the McCarthy era and was tied to Communist Party scapegoating, which, given your setup for the question, goes to show that a lot of legal issues and a lot of the laws that are invoked at different times in different ways are very much reactive and or responsive to the political, moment that we're living in.
No, I was also, to prep for this interview, I was watching, different Supreme Court justices' speeches on like free speech and all that stuff. And one of them that stuck out to me was like Justice Scalia, for all that he's worth. He was arguing in this interview, I forgot from where, but that if you are present in the United States, regardless of your legal status, you are entitled to the same due process and have access to the same rights outside of like voting, of course, that every other citizen of this country or resident of this country has. So it's like, how far away are we moving from that? Like, Yeah, but anyways, what does this mean for other activists now? Because just a couple of minutes before we got on this call, a Tufts University student by the name of Rumeysa Öztürk, apologize if I'm butchering that name, was kidnapped in broad daylight. The way that happened, it was like masked men just like grabbing them. These are things that probably have happened before that we didn't pay attention to, but because they're under the Trump administration, liberals are paying attention to it. That's another thing I want to dive into. You know, like everybody's crying about now how democracy is dead, fascism is here. Like, if democracy is dead and fascism is here, the Democrats rolled out the red carpet initially because they were the ones sending militarized police forces back in 2024 to shoot American kids, 18 and 24-year-olds on college campuses, as opposed to negotiating with them. But anyways, enough editorializing. So, you know, this student was taken away. And then there is another Columbia University student who has been in the United States and is a permanent resident since 7 years old. There is a Georgetown researcher, Badar Khan. There's a Brown University professor, all having like different legal statuses, of course. Like, but they, one thing that they have in common is Palestine. So, you know, what does this mean for anyone at this moment who is speaking out against what the establishment is telling them not to speak about?
I mean, I think the ripple effects are real. A lot of people who've been in the movement and in solidarity with Palestine and Palestinians for a long time talk often about the Palestine exception. And, Anthony Lowenstein recently wrote a book called The Palestine Laboratory. And that was weapons specific about how, Israel's like, I think the 10th largest weapons manufacturer in the world. And that they often say that their weapons are battle tested. And, who are they tested on? We know the answer to that. I think that the bellwether often in this in recent years is has been Palestine. And so I think to your point about what does this mean for students and for activists more generally, I think that what we're seeing here is a bellwether again, where so go where goes Palestine, so goes a lot of other things, right? So as they pick off activists and people who even have spoken, had Instagram posts and other such things regarding Palestine liberation or Palestinian liberation or Palestinian, even just human rights, or like, using the term genocide, which, as we know, is accepted and, the International Court of Justice has called it a plausible genocide, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, like, the list goes
Betzalel.
on and on. And so I think that what we're seeing here is a broader attack on dissent in general, and I actually would reframe I dissent, yes, but I think it's actually a broader attack on individuals who are imagining a different way that America and other countries could be. And because I always like I always don't I feel uncomfortable framing certain movements as a negative, like what they're working against, because I actually think that a lot of students and a lot of people in our country who are working in solidarity with Palestinians who are Palestinian are speaking out for and with their communities, Black Lives Matter activists, abolitionists, like climate justice advocates, reproductive justice advocates, they're not just fighting against something repressive. They're fighting for a vision. They're fighting for something that is inclusive, that where people get their basic needs met, where people are met with dignity, that their humanity is honored in our laws, in our policies, in our streets. And so I think what we're seeing is an attack on those visions. So it's not dissent that's being attacked. It's the vision of something different, and it's the truth tellers to the people, not I heard a very smart person once say, we're not speaking truth to power. Power knows the truth. We're
Doesn't
speaking
care.
truth to the people. And
Right.
when you're effective at speaking the truth to the people, you're a danger to the status quo.
Right.
Because once the people start coalescing, once we start looking each other in the eye, once we get in the same room with each other and we hear each other out, then then we have power. And I
Right.
think that's why scapegoating is such a powerful tool and why what we're seeing here is so powerful. If we are all walking in fear all the time that if we open our mouths, if we break bread together, if we cross community lines and bring folks together, if we are our unique, beautiful selves, whatever that looks like, whatever that feels like in your skin, and you're not willing to adhere to any particular boundary or any particular label, if you're any of those things, they want to scoop you up because you're an example of what's possible.
Right.
And I think that that is something that's really powerful. And the thing that we can, the ripple impact and the hope is dividing and conquering, which is where the scapegoating thing comes in, and isolation. I'm too scared to leave my house. And and there are a lot of other very real impacts, family separation, which is happening to Mahmoud right now and his wife, and so many other families, them just taking people and sending them to who even knows where, and people don't even know where they are. But all of that is an attempt to isolate and divide, right? And I think something that movements are doing and need to continue, there always needs to be a threat assessment. There always needs to be a risk assessment. Not everybody is situated similarly, and we can definitely talk about that. And so I'm not saying that all people all the time should risk everything. Obviously, people need to do their own calculus. If you're a single parent and you're the only one for your child, all those kinds of factors. At the same time, I think we have a powerful opportunity to choose to be in community with each other, to choose not to isolate. We might feel fear, but we can feel fear together in the same room. And so I think for movements, what this means for us is that we need to continue to gather. We need to continue to break bread. We need to continue to build bridges. We can't privilege one movement over another movement all the time. I think there can be some liquid leadership there around where the harm is greatest at any given moment, but not fighting over the crumbs that the powers that be give us, but choosing to like put our crumbs together and actually do some things. And so while this is a very terrifying movement, and as I said, people need to really do the calculus smartly with the risk, I also think we're all at risk anyway in a lot of different ways. And so we might as well be in community with each other and not choose to engage in the rhetoric, the division, not choose to view each other as threats or as, a zero-sum perspective that if you get yours, I don't get mine, like that kind of thing. I think there's an opportunity here to counter this narrative of, of loss, to counter this narrative of not having enough, not getting yours, like all that kind of stuff, and choosing to continue to be together in movement. And I hear that from Mahmoud all the time, as well as the people around him. And as we hold the tension in the legal case as to connection to movement versus what's best for the law, like the legal aspects of the case and holding those tensions. But I think for the movements that you're talking about, it is a really scary time. And I personally walk around with fear and anxiety all the time, but I think that I'm choosing to meet with you and we're choosing to look at each other through these rectangles on the screen because it's important whether we're physically together or digitally together, like online, it's important for us to continue to view each other as community members, neighbors, colleagues, friends, and to not allow this divisiveness to play out in our communities.
Absolutely. And, by that metric, you are absolutely a threat to the status quo. Let me just say that. And then
Don't say that too loudly.
just for the two of us on here, thank you so much for that, by the way. But I want to, we all saw Mahmoud's wife, talking to you on the phone, and we saw Mahmoud saying, call Amy, call Amy. Now we know who Amy is. Could you tell us how he is doing, how his wife is doing? because we know that she's expecting in a couple of weeks. You also told me that you were just on the phone with him before we hopped on this call.
Yeah.
How are things for him? We've all read his letter many and many times. What is he telling you? How are the conditions out there?
So, I mean, as I've said many times, he's detained, and that is a horrible experience for anyone. And he's also separated from the people he loves most in the world, which I think, and expecting his first child. So he's not just separated from his amazing wife, but also, he was going to appointments with her, like, getting ready for their first baby. And so it was also a really hard time to be separated. I think, he's trying to stay positive. He is somebody who always thinks about the collective. I think it's just who he is. And so he's very worried about these other students that you brought up earlier and, what's happening in the movements more generally, if people are okay. He's doing well as can be, and I think trying to remain hopeful. His wife is doing all right as well. She has a lot of support, but it's hard when you have a lot of people around you who are wonderful, but they're not the one that you want to be. I mean, obviously she wants to be around the people she's with, but there's one that's absent, and I think that absence feels very palpable. Oh, and you asked about conditions. So, I mean, he doesn't talk much about conditions because he's worried about everybody else. He's talked about how it's cold, but people in Gaza don't even have roofs over their head. I mean, I think this is what you heard me say the other day is, the food's not that great, but there are people who are starving around the world. And I think the other big concern that he sees is that while his case has been heavily publicized, and a lot of us are out here we've taken his case, we're fighting it in court, we've done all of these things. He said there's just a lot of people languishing there, that there's a lot of people that the world has forgotten about, or so, like, the thing about you had asked earlier about these students and other people who are being taken, it's horrific, and many of them have been in pairs and in groups, and where somebody can record what's happened, or have a person to call. They've already connected with attorneys, and attorneys are looking for them. There's so many people in this country, and Mahmoud talks about this, who are snatched that way, whose communities don't have those resources. There may be a language barrier. They're new to the country and they don't know how the process works, so they wouldn't even know where to look for the person, to even know where to start. They don't have an attorney who can stay up all night and file a habeas petition, things like that. And so I think he's really conscious and seeing, the toll that that's taking on so many people in this country, families, communities. And so when he speaks about conditions, like, you can't get him to talk about how he's doing or if he's getting the meds he needs or whatever. You hear more about, like, there needs to be more lawyers, or this person got bond, but they can't afford it. Is there a fund we can connect them to, or something like that?
Amazing.
So he's still collective minded. That hasn't changed. And sometimes we have to talk him out of collective-minded things because it would be detrimental to his legal defense. And you feel like a terrible person when you're like, I know this is really important to you, but if you do this, it could not, So they're okay, but mindful of all the people that are around him that aren't and who aren't. So, yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Amy. The last question I want to ask you is, what do you say to people who view this as a national security issue rather than as a free speech issue or like a civil liberties issue? And how can those who want to support Mahmoud support and help? And others in his situation, obviously.
No, of course. I'll take the first one first so I can think a little bit. I mean, the second one first. So for supporting Mahmoud, the family has created, like, a fund for because of Mahmoud not working right now, obviously, and things like that. It's on Chuffed, so you can find it there. I'd be happy to provide the link.
Amazing.
I
I'll
don't
link
recall it
it.
off the top of my head. The other thing that's happening is there are legal funds popping up everywhere for student defense more broadly, both affirmative lawsuits regarding speech and discrimination violations, which goes to your first question, as well as defensive, because we're going to see more lawfare going forward against student activists, et cetera, where they're hauled into court into civil suits and criminal suits, and we're going to see a lot more of that. So, groups like Palestine Legal, the Center for Constitutional Rights, CARE, the Council for American and Islamic Relations, who's my co-counsel in a case where we're suing Columbia Congress and some executive agencies for First Amendment issues. So those entities are places to donate. There are also smaller legal defense funds that you can look up more locally for both people facing immigration related issues, or bail funds for activists as well as student movements. So keep an eye out in your local community for those kinds of mutual aid and legal aid opportunities. Mahmoud would want you to give your money to those spaces as well. As to the national security question, I struggle with that question so much, because what does national security mean entirely? And who are we protecting, and from whom, and from what? So I think one of the things that I really circle back to, and I've just been sitting with this a lot in the moments I have been sitting still, which are pretty rare these days, but for all the flaws of our Constitution, and there are many that many of us discuss probably on a regular basis, a group of white men gathered together and decided that our rights to speech, expression, and association, or assembly, they called it, and religion, were so important that they should go first. And when you think about the founding of this country, again, recognizing, all of the immense harm that came from the founding, so I am not glorifying it in any way. And also at the same time, the thinking of some of these men who are writing this, think about the famous Boston Tea Party, and think about the revol, leading up to the revolution, which became, a military battle against the British monarchy. Prior to that, there were anybody writing newspaper articles or broadsheets or printing books or printing anything that was calling for independence or for creating a state separate from England, those people were like put to death. They were pilloried, all these kinds of things. There was a recognition that when people gather together in assembly and start thinking about what's possible, like we said before, that it does challenge the power and the status quo, the powers that be in the status quo. And so I would just say that the First Amendment, when you think about it in that context, when it was written, there was an understanding that the country primarily benefits, our nation primarily benefits when these rights are protected and recognized, because we wouldn't actually be here as a nation had had people not bravely spoken, and taken different kinds of protest actions like the Tea Party and other such things. And I'm sure that historians will roll their eyes at my simplistic, sort of framing of this, but I just keep thinking, I keep coming back to, there's a reason they put it first. Imperfect and racist, likely, and enslavers they may be, they still recognized that in order for a nation like this to survive, there had to be a freedom of speech, expression, and assembly. And so, as I sit with that, what does national security and speech and assembly, if what are what's the nation we're securing if the essence of who we think we are starts eroding, and to your point earlier, the civil rights movement and the Black liberation movements in the 50s and 60s, long before that too. I mean, if you look at Robin DG Kelly's work and others, obviously that work goes way back. But what we always think of as the civil rights and the Black liberation movements of the 60s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, the Vietnam War, the anti-nuclear movements, women's liberation movements, and women's suffrage. I mean, all of these things led to moments of critical juncture in our country. Things were fraught, things were tense. My dad has told me that in the 60s, he was convinced we were going to have another civil war. But people persisted, and we ended up with a slightly better, a slightly more equitable nation than we were before. We have a long way to go. And, we can debate reform versus revolution. We can debate all those kinds of things.
But we can't
But
debate
in
that without.
theory, anyway, that pushing, that persistence, that expression, that speech, that right to protest and assembly has sometimes led us in negative directions, but it's also led us in many more positive, slightly more positive directions. And so I guess for me, when I think about national security and as somebody who works in that space a little bit as a defender and, who has studied it, and frankly, I was deeply changed by 9/11 and then America's actions following 9/11, which is what brought me to law school ultimately many years later, and watching our invasion into Iraq and Afghanistan and other spaces was very formative for me in my early 20s. And watching with horror, I should specify. And so, I think that as we process all of this and think about national security and all of that, like secure for whom, secure for what, national what, and if we're and how speech when we've challenged our own selves to think differently, to imagine better, imagine something that works for more people, it's been scary for a lot of people who feel like they're going to lose something in that process. But ultimately, I think that most of us ended up gaining something in that process. And I hope that we kind of keep that long arc view, as we think this through and process it. I don't know. So the
Right.
long of the answer is, I don't know. I don't know what to say to the, to people who think in that kind of binary. Because I live in nuance, but I think the fact that the framers put that first should tell us something.
And I think, all the stuff that you're talking about are moot if we can't debate them and have differing political opinions and have people we disagree with. And that's what the First Amendment is for. And if you don't believe in it for people you violently disagree with, then you don't believe in it at all. And so, like I keep telling everyone, I miss those conservatives and libertarians that used to tell us, I have Second Amendment in case you try to take away my First Amendment. So I'm gonna leave it here. Amy, thank you so much for joining me on Let's Just Talk. And we hope to have you back again to give us updates and to keep us posted. Continue the great fight, and thank you for all you do.
Yeah, well, thank you, Emmy, for what you do too. I really appreciate your time and creating space for a longer conversation instead of quick sound bites. I really appreciate that a lot.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Yeah.